In the summer of 2020, Golf Digest introduced Local Knowledge as an opportunity to tell stories that went deeper than the most recent headlines. Since then, we've told stories about golf from a number of different perspectives: how the game is played, how it's changed, who makes money, and who struggles to get by. Along the way, we've also sought to tell the stories of people we felt audiences needed to know. From trailblazers to folk heroes to singular personalities, these figures have made for some of our favorite subjects, whether they racked up major championships or controversial headlines, and in some cases, both. All of them were compelling stories. I'm Alex Myers, and on this special episode of Local Knowledge, we've combed through our first two seasons to revisit some of our favorite characters. We start with Babe Didrikson Zaharias. The Babe died 65 years ago, after a heroic battle with cancer, but her incredible and inspiring story lives on. Last spring, I talked with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Don Van Natta Jr., whose 2011 book Wonder Girl remains the seminal work on this almost mythical figure. The Babe didn't just beat her opponents on the golf course. She dominated virtually every sport she played. Long before she became a major champion, she was an Olympic gold medalist in track and field.
One of the great things about Babe Didrikson is she had the brash self-confidence of a Muhammad Ali before Muhammad Ali. You know, she declared, "I'm going to be the greatest," even as a little girl growing up, as you said, on the wrong side of the tracks in Beaumont, Texas. She said, "Someday I am going to be the greatest athlete of all time." Now, she didn't say the greatest woman athlete of all time. She said the greatest athlete of all time. Right. She didn't look at her gender as a barrier to her success, which is really extraordinary when you think about that at the time she grew up. You know, this is born in 1911. These are the 1920s when she started aspiring to be a great athlete.
You could argue her lofty claim of becoming the greatest athlete eventually came true. When the Associated Press and ESPN released their rankings of the 100 greatest athletes of the century in 2000, Didrikson made the top 10 of both, a few slots below the other Babe. Here's how Dan Patrick introduced her on the accompanying ESPN Sports Century documentary.
She made DiMaggio's swing and miss and outplayed Sarrazin. She excelled at basketball, bowling, billiards, tennis, softball, diving, archery, golf, and five Olympic events. Babe Didrikson gave birth to the modern woman athlete.
Babe constantly battled the rampant sexism that existed during her time, and even had to overcome questions about her sexuality. But she finally fit in on a tour she co-founded.
Really, the LPGA was built for Babe. The first several years, Babe was the draw. She was, by just the force of her personality and the fact that she was so good and she won so many of the tournaments, people came out to see her those first few years. And the LPGA really wouldn't have happened, I don't think, at least not in 1950 when it was founded, if it wasn't for Babe Didrikson.
Right from the start, Babe dominated the LPGA, winning a combined 17 events the first 2 years and easily being the tour's top earner. She had more money than she could have ever imagined when growing up poor in Beaumont. She was making the headlines she craved again. And then she encountered her biggest hurdle yet.
Babe, though, when she got the cancer diagnosis, she was told, "You're never going to play golf again." And she believed it for a while. She actually tried to give her golf clubs away. That's how despondent she was.
But Babe decided she wasn't through with golf. Although forced to wear a colostomy bag and sapped of some of her famous power off the tee, she somehow returned to limited fashion to the LPGA just 4 months after surgery. The following January, she won an LPGA event, then was invited to the White House by President Eisenhower to kick off a cancer crusade. But her heroics were just beginning, because what happened at the 1954 U.S. Women's Open that July almost defies description. The author of the greatest track and field feat ever came back two decades later to pull off arguably the most impressive victory in golf history. Just 15 months after undergoing surgery for cancer, Didrikson went wire to wire at Salem Country Club, overcoming that colostomy bag strapped to her side and a grueling 36-hole final day to win by an astonishing 12 shots.
Mrs. Zaharias has the crown wrapped up. Just 18 months ago, she underwent an operation for cancer. Everyone said her career was over, but here she is, winning by a mile, a margin of 12 strokes with a score of 291, one of the most inspiring comebacks in all sports history.
An all-time blowout. an all-time comeback. It would be like if you combined Tiger Woods' 2000 US Open and 2019 Masters wins into one. And this time, Babe sounded more grateful and humbler than ever before.
I don't like to keep bringing up this hospital deal of mine, but I was laying there in room 201 at the Hotel Du Hospital, and these reports were going out about that I'd never play championship or tournament golf again. And I laid in the bed and I says, please God, let me play again. And he answered my prayer. And I want to thank God for letting me win again. It's really wonderful.
Jan Stevenson followed in Babe's footsteps to become one of the LPGA's best players of the 1970s and 80s. But while the Australian won 16 times, including three majors, she drew far more attention for her appearance. And this was by design of the LPGA Tour's first commissioner, Ray Volpe. Last February, Keely Levin spoke with Stevenson about her controversial career.
You know, I kind of just shrugged my shoulders and went, you know, if this is what's going to help the tour, I've just got to enjoy it. I did this, but so long ago that nobody even knows how close we were to losing the tour. And what I did was a sacrifice for all of us.
At player meetings, Jan recalls the sentiment being split, with Volpe fending off accusations from players who said he was selling sex over golf.
And he goes, it's not sex, it's sex appeal. And then he would say, everything is sold that way in marketing, believe me. And he goes, you're going to thank her in the end, because the galleries and I'm going to have, you know, we're going to be on TV. And we did. We had enormous galleries. So after a year, they started to see what he was talking about. Because the first year, they were dead against it. I mean, I'd walk into a locker room and there'd be silence because I know they were talking about me, and, you know, and a lot of the players didn't like it.
Of course, there was a personal benefit too. Purses on the LPGA Tour grew in the 70s and 80s, but placing in tournaments didn't promise a comfortable life. The first tournament Stevenson won, her winner's check was $8,500. With the level of celebrity she reached off the course, she was getting more sponsors and was being paid big appearance fees to show up at different events.
Every time we'd go play a tournament, I'd be on the front, you know, the front of the paper and all the magazines. And that part was fun, but it was really taking its toll. I remember in 77, I was really upset because I didn't win a tournament and I felt like that hurt. So then when I sat with the commissioner and I said, you know, I think this is hurting me. Towards the end of the year, we were in Japan, and I just said, you know, I think the reason I didn't win was because even though I had a really good scoring average, that one little stroke from being tied and not seeing a practice, you know, not having a practice round, you know, I felt like it was really hurting me. And he said, well, why don't you rest this winter and I'll try to, now that we've got Lopez doing so much, I'll see if she can do some media stuff as well.
Since then, Stevenson helped start and won on the Women's Senior Tour, which is now known as the Legends Tour. She studied under Pete Dye to learn course design and has been designing and renovating golf courses, now running one of her own. And she also runs and owns a wine and liquor label. If she sounds busy, it's because she is. The day before we spoke for this podcast, she'd been at Brittany Lincicone's fundraiser event with current LPGA Tour players.
It was so great for me. I mean, I'm not even sure if they really understand, but to see them in these gorgeous outfits and, you know, their hair done beautifully and these little tiny short skirts that I was always in trouble for. And it's actually, you know, it kind of made me smile, but it was really nice that they, you know, obviously have taken it to another level.
Stevenson looks at the tour now and sees the television time they're getting, the sponsors, the $76.5 million in annual purse money.
When I see all those young players yesterday, I mean, it's wonderful to see how great they look and what they're enjoying. And, you know, you can't help but be envious. You know, I'm not jealous or miserable, but I'm just like, God, they don't know how lucky and what a great life they have. Because as much as I tease people now and they go, you work so hard. And it's like, you know what? And they said, you worked so hard at golf, but I loved it because if I had it over again, I would probably work even harder. And maybe if I'd have finished without being forced to finish, you know, the way I finished, being the way I was, had to go away from it without having, working that hard and not having it pay off. You know, that part is probably the hardest part to me to face.
Mo Norman had it hard for different reasons. A misunderstood loner, he never found a fit on the PGA Tour despite being known as one of the best ball strikers of all time. Although never formally diagnosed with autism, those close to the Canadian strongly believed he was on what we now consider the spectrum, given his many idiosyncrasies, which included his fixation with hitting golf balls. Norman worked at his swing until, as he put it, he had it trapped, and those who saw the unusual motion that produced uncanny accuracy never forgot it. One such person was David Owen, who profiled the man known as Pipeline Mo for Golf Digest in 1995.
To see somebody hit drivers out of pitching wedge divots and have them look exactly like the drivers he hit off the tee, or four irons out of pitching wedge divots, really, really kind of incredible.
Tiger Woods once said, only two players have ever truly owned their swings, Mo Norman and Ben Hogan. But why did the latter win 9 major championships while the former's biggest victories all came in Canada? How is it possible that someone with such command of the golf ball never won a Masters, or never even competed in a US Open where accuracy is rewarded above all? The answer lies less in how Mo constructed his swing and more in how Mo himself was wired.
I'm way different. I'm in a different world. I'm way up there looking down. I hit my position so well. Oh, just like pressing a button, just like a machine.
According to the CDC, autism affects 1 in 54 children in the United States. But those effects are wide-ranging, which is why people are described as being on a spectrum. Typical characteristics of autism include trouble communicating, repetitive behavior, displaying unusual interest in certain things, and tending to overreact to certain senses. All of these applied to Mo, who wasn't comfortable in social settings and didn't like to be touched. Autism would also explain Mo's obsessive behavior when it came to practicing his swing. It's possible that no one in history, not even Ben Hogan, who was known for digging his secret out of the dirt through countless hours on the range, hit as many golf balls as Mo Norman.
It didn't come to me. I had to work. I worked. I got off this thing. The other guys were playing cards, pouring rain. I was out there. Here's my shirt. I'm rinsing and hitting again. There's blood coming down my hands. That's how much I liked it when I was a kid. Even though it wasn't a sport like it is today, I did it because I liked hitting the ball good. That's the thrill I got out of it, was to be able to hit nice, pure shots in such a simple way that I was like a part of it. I was attached to my golf shots. I was. I still am. I'm still when I hit a ball, I feel I'm going with it. It's pulling me to happiness. And it does.
David Owen relayed a story that shows just how much Mo was pulled towards practicing.
Maui talked about one time he was taking Mo to play in a tournament, and as they walked to the registration tent or the first tee, they passed the driving range, and the driving range had those little, you know, those little pyramids of brand new range balls stacked up, and Mo saw him out of the corner of his eye, and he looked at him. He didn't want to play in the tournament. He wanted to go hit those balls.
Which is not to say Norman didn't win. He did. A lot. Mo still boasted an incredible on-course resume that speaks to both his dominance and longevity. He was a 2-time Canadian amateur winner and a 2-time Canadian PGA Championship winner. He won a record 55 Canadian Tour titles, and after turning 50, he won 7 consecutive Canadian PGA Seniors Championships. He also set 33 course records, fired 359s, and is a member of both the Canadian Golf Hall of Fame and Canada's Sports Hall of Fame.
He was an amazing guy, and I think the way to look at it is not to think what could have been, but to be just astonished by what actually was.
During his 36 years at Golf Digest, Guy Yoakam dealt with Mo Norman and just about every other bold-faced name you can think of in the sport. Last December, the recently retired writer shared some amazing memories of covering the game's biggest stars with our Dan Rappaport. Here's Guy on what made Lee Trevino so special.
He would re-grip the club during the swing. He would talk while he was actually hitting the golf ball. He was a genius with that. And then, of course, his personality. When you were with him, he's the best interview in the world. you just kind of like wind him up and watch him go. I mean, next thing you know, like Lee would be telling you how to win a fist fight. You ever get in a fight? Well, if you're little, get in close. If you're tall, stay away. Get him on the ground. Always get the first punch in. He would just go on and on with stuff like that. And just weird physiology. He got 28 teeth crowned without Novocaine.
Because he was too tough for it, or what?
He just had a high pain threshold. He just seemed to be made of different stuff than most humans. You know, his story, he talked about, you know, he grew up poor. He dug it out of the ground, and he just... he's the one guy that, you know, Nicholas couldn't intimidate him. Nobody could intimidate Lee Trevino.
But one golf legend did intimidate Guy, Ben Hogan. And as someone who heard Guy tell the story of interviewing the legend on his home turf in Fort Worth many times at the office cafeteria through the years, I can say it never gets old.
I went and bought a blazer just for the occasion. I didn't have one with me. I was just down covering a golf tournament. And bought a blazer, told everybody at the office, you know, when I called on the phone to tell them I was doing this, nobody could believe it. Dan Jenkins said, why the hell is he seeing you? And so I went over to his office there on Pafford Street, and I was there at 9 o'clock sharp, and Doxie Williams said, you know, Mr. Hogan's running a little late. He just got here, and he needs his cup of coffee. And I said, okay. So I went into this vestibule, and I'm waiting, I'm looking at these pictures on the wall, and I'm just scared. You know, I'm nervous. This guy's my hero. He's everybody's hero. And I just hear this, I guess he crept up on me like a cat, because this voice kind of boomed in my ear. He said, are you Guy? And I turned around, and my face is a foot away from Ben Hogan, and I'm looking into those blue blades, you know, those eyes of his. And just his presence, and he had his hand out, and I shook his hand, and I choked. I really did. It was such a terrible interview.
Wait, you just blew it?
I just totally blew it. I was just in awe of it. It was too big, okay? It was like the weight of it, and I'm in his office, and I would sit in this chair, and the seat part of it was tilted slightly downward. And I think that this seat was waxed because I kept sliding forward and then reaching up to pick myself upright in this thing. And it was unnerving. You would lose your train of thought because you would sink in and slip down there and gather yourself. And I looked up at Hogan. I looked at Hogan, you know, 10 minutes in. I'm saying, like, what is with this chair? And he just looked at me and smiled like it was his secret weapon he had to keep people off balance. But it was amazing, and he signed a book for me, and as I was leaving, Ben Crenshaw was coming in, and I can always say I did it.
Yoakam had a much easier time getting to know a young Phil Mickelson. And as you'll hear, the future six-time major champ has always been an interesting interview, as well as a showman.
This is right after he turned pro, because I kind of became friends with Phil, and I would stay with him when I would go out to Arizona, and he had a condo. It was his first place that he bought. We would just hang around his condo and talk. He wanted to know about everything. He was really interested in the Kennedy assassination. It would be deep space, telecommunications, and it didn't matter what the subject was. He loved card magic and doing card tricks. He just had this really fertile mind. But as we would talk, and I'm just sitting on the couch and Phil would be up pacing and be restless, he would reach over and he would grab this Ping Elwich. He still played Ping at this time. And Phil would, while he would talk, he didn't even really know he was doing this, but I was watching him. He would just plop a ball down and he would flick it with one hand with this wedge. He would flick it off and it would pop straight up in the air. This is off a marble floor, almost straight up in the air. It would just kind of go by his left pocket. And he would reach with his other hand and catch it and then throw it down and do it again. And tell me more about Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, he would say, so we would do this, and he did it. I counted. He did this 9 times in a row before he finally drop kicked one or thinned one.
We end with Kyle Berkshire, who is to the sport of long driving what Usain Bolt was to sprinting. With his own special kind of speed that produces swings of 150 miles per hour, Berkshire has won 3 World Long Drive Championships before the age of 25 in convincing fashion. The long-haired hitter has become the face of the sport, and in some ways is responsible for Bryson DeChambeau making his recent long drive debut. But Berkshire, a former college golfer at North Texas, has a lofty goal of joining his friend on the PGA Tour someday. And in an age where the line between tour pros and long drivers seems to be more blurred than ever, he might just be part of a new wave of bombers pursuing the world of competitive golf. In our final episode of 2020, I talked with the confident Berkshire about his next career goal, and to others who weighed in on where the sport could be headed thanks to today's power pioneers.
I think it's great to be a long drive champion, and that's a huge deal to me, but I don't want to be that guy that avoids potential failure. I'm not going to try to be this untouchable guy who's unbelievable what he does. I want to push myself, and I have an opportunity to do something great.
Right.
And I'm in a position in my life to really pursue it. And I'm kind of putting it on the line here.
And Bryson DeChambeau is indeed a U.S. Open champion at Wingfoot.
Although plenty of other players had pushed the game in that direction, it's DeChambeau who has underscored the direct correlation between driving distance and tournament success. In gaining 20 yards to increase his average to 322 yards off the tee, he also became the PGA Tour's leader in strokes gained driving. One person paying attention was Kyle Berkshire.
Watching Bryson win the US Open at Wingfoot was the moment, I think. If I ever make it on tour, that's the moment I'm always going to go back to. That started everything for me in terms of this drive. He made every single pundit and critic look like a complete jackass. And that appeals to me. That appeals to me very greatly. And, you know, that's something that I really want to do is prove everyone wrong and prove everyone that believes in me right.
One pundit who hasn't been surprised by DeChambeau's distance experiment succeeding is Brandel Chamblee. And the Golf Channel analyst uses a baseball analogy to explain why he won't be shocked if Berkshire or another long driver finds his way to the PGA Tour.
You know, imagine there were 40 guys who got together for kicks and they all threw it at about 120, 118 miles an hour, faster than the fastest in professional baseball. Well, that's what's been going on in the world of professional golf as we look at the longest drivers in professional golf.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, there's 50 or 100 or 200 guys over here that drive it miles longer. I mean, miles faster. I mean, they're swinging 150 miles an hour. The best on the PGA Tour is 125 miles an hour. It would have been ludicrous to think that those pitchers wouldn't have made their way into Major League Baseball, or the moves that they had wouldn't have made their way. The fastest pitchers were in the majors. Mm-hmm. They were in the bigs. The fastest swingers are not playing at the highest level in golf. It's crazy to think that those moves are not going to make their way into professional golf.
Although Berkshire doesn't have a specific timetable on when he will start entering tournaments, he plans to start small with Florida mini tour events, even though he could likely use his long drive stardom to get a few starts on the PGA Tour. Again, the goal isn't just to play against the best, but to eventually be one of the best.
If I emailed every event I could and asked for an exemption, it's very probable that I wouldn't have to write too many before I would get one.
Right.
But, you know, again, I want to make sure that I make this entrance the right way. I don't want to go out and shoot 80-80 and get blown away. I want to go out and I want to make a statement. I'll know when I'm ready.
This special episode of Local Knowledge is the first in a series that revisits some of our favorite episodes from our first two seasons. Local Knowledge is produced by Gregory Gottfried with editorial guidance from Sam Wyman. Our music for today's episode is called Trapper John, and it's by Lobo Loco. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Golf Digest's weekly gambling podcast, Be Right. Thank you.